On May 1st of 2016, Trevor Blake and I took to the lectern at Mother Foucault's bookstore in Portland, Oregon. The entire event was recorded, and I introduced Mr. Blake. Unfortunately, I did a sound level check by having Trevor speak, and he is a very soft-spoken man, in public and in private. I, however, am not, and rendered my introduction unlistenable by blowing out all the sound levels, pretty much every other word. So what follows will be my in-studio reading of that very introduction that I gave, followed by Trevor's live on-stage talk. My name is Kevin I. Slaughter, and I am a small publisher, going at it under the name Underworld Amusements since 2007. I've published at least 30 books, made a few videos, recorded a few podcasts, and have a small distro that sells heretical, dissident, and reactionary books. Over that time, a few people have even bought one or two of those books. I specialize in dusting off and whoring up forgotten books by dead people who weren't that popular in the first place, much less now. I have been working directly with Mr. Blake since around 2012 when he approached me with his manuscript for Confessions of a Failed Egoist. And it was that very same year that I published a collection of egoist writing, mostly culled from early 20th century writers, titled A Bible Not Borrowed from the Neighbors, Essays and Aphorisms on Egoism. It was April 1st of 2014 that his book was published, and 1 month later, he was welcomed by the gracious Mother Foucault to announce it. And today is the third annual announcement for a book that Trevor has written for that I have published, and it's about damn time I showed up for it. Today is also different, for Mr. Blake will also introduce you to a book that he has published himself, a bibliography of Max Stirner. Now, I will let him do that properly, but I will say that I am proud to finally have made it here to stand before him and you and say a few words. And I thank our hosts and you, our audience, friends, strangers, and hopefully no enemies. Because Mr. Blake's task is to talk about these books, I will not. I will say that in our fourth year of collaboration, things have seriously escalated. He and I share not only similar passions, but are similarly passionate about them. That we both have a long history of small publishing, obscure work with limited audience has produced a sort of super duo of obscurantism. And this has revealed itself 1 month ago, on the first day of April 2016. And that was in the announcement of the Union of Egoists and Der Geist blog, podcast, and journal. The Union of Egoists describes not only the working relationship between Trevor and myself, but puts a name on the gathering together of a good deal of the overlapping subjects of our obsessions. Iconoclasts, radicals, Satanists, and dissidents form the core of our work, men and women, and their views that are largely beyond good and evil, but also largely forgotten. The unifying feature being that they hold the primacy of the individual as being the most important and central pillar of their worldview. Where the world says God first, they say, who, me? Not only am I incredibly biased, but it would appear I am financially incentivized to express how wonderful Confessions of a Failed Egoist, The Gospel According to Malthus Seklu, and Outbursts of Everett True are, as published by Underworld Amusements. But I don't want you to take my word for it, or any authority. Buy 4 copies each and make up your own damn mind. And with that, I will cede the lectern to my comrade and friend, Trevor Blake.
The Outbursts of Everett True by A.D. Condor, J.W. Rapper. My Biggest Thrill by A.D. Kondo. My first thrill as a newspaper artist on assignment was experienced while on the staff of the Toledo News, before that very eccentric publication was taken over by the Scripps concern. This was way back in 1896. A young man had committed suicide on the grave of his sweetheart, and this bit of information had been telephoned in from the cemetery where the tragedy had occurred. The reporter and myself, whom the city editor sent immediately to the scene, arrived all right and were directed by the superintendent to a portion of the cemetery where he said we could find the body lying on the grave. We found the place. Pending the arrival of the coroner, someone had crossed the young man's hands over his breast and placed a handkerchief over his face and, on top of that, a big hat. Of course, the reporter wasn't hampered much by this arrangement, but I couldn't get very far with a portrait unless some further action was taken looking to the exposure of the corpse's face. This was my first job of such a nature for both the reporter and myself, and I intimated to the former that he might do the uncovering, but he suggested pointedly that I do it myself. The day was bitter cold. Summoning courage sufficient to overcome natural reluctance, I removed the hat and then the handkerchief. Thrill. A pallid face was turned to the wintry sky and very large blue eyes stared into space with the fixity that death imparts. By this time, the intense cold and the excitement got their fine work. My associate jotted down his notes with numb and trembling hands, and I made my sketch with the same kind of hand. I've chosen to read this section to give you something of the character of the author of Outburst True, A.D. Kondo. Armando Dries Bach Kondo, in 1904, was kept awake all night by a neighbor whose cylinder phonograph had not been removed from the cylinder, and the rasp, rasp, rasp all night long made him wonder, as he lay awake, why is there no avenger for such small slights? And thus Everett True was born. Or perhaps Kondo's newspaper editor suggested to Jack Rapper, the artist of the outburst, a character named Truthful James, who was always compelled to tell the truth and act on it. Rapper changed it instead to Everett True. It's one of those two stories, perhaps a third story, some of each, and also some of what was in the air in late 1800s, early 1900s Chicago. Everett True began as an alternating comic strip, and in short order, by 1917, it was in 250 newspapers across the U.S. as a daily comic. It was published continuously from the early 1900s into 1957, and even as late as 1968, Everett True, the character, was appearing in Alley Oop comics in a time-traveling episode of same. Everett True was collected in a book in 1907, and that's 30 years before the first issue of Action Comics. Before the first comic book, there was a book of comics of Everett True, very popular. The collection was published again in 1921, again in 1983, but this book, ladies and gentlemen, includes none of that. It's all new strips that have not been seen the light of day of print, or the darkness of print, since that time. Taking these yellowed strips and transferring them into the sharp, almost cutting black ink you see here is indebted eternally to Michael Brumish, who joins us today. Also, thank you to Michael for making this book look so fantastic. Thank you to Kevin to publish it. One of the strips that True alternated with was called Diana Dillpickle. She was a flapper, a free thinker, a carefree spirit. And in the early 1900s, also in Chicago, there was the Dill Pickle Club. One wonders if the ribald spirit of the Dill Pickle Club influenced not only Diana Dill Pickle, drawn by Jack Rapper, but also the libertine with fisticuffs character of Mr. Everett True, Now, copies of Outbursts of Everett True will be for sale. You may examine it, judge for yourself in this regard. Two regulars of the Dill Pickle Club were Malfeu Seklu and Ragnar Redbeard. In 1927, the same year, they each published their own book, The Gospel According to Malfeu Seklu, and Might is Right by Ragnar Redbeard. Seklu was the laughing philosopher of Lancashire, a social aristocrat and a surfesser. One step above professor is surfesser. Surfesser Malfeu Seklu now speaks to us from beyond the grave and across the century, speaking his own gospel. All life is selfish. All reform is selfish. All politics is selfish. All war is selfish. All business is selfish. All thought is selfish, and all action is selfish. All is selfish, and selfishness is rampant with and without reason throughout the world. Selfishness is necessary to preserve one's self. Vanity is necessary to assert oneself, and hate is necessary to protect oneself from one's enemies. Love, based on ignorance, is unbridled selfishness, a calamity and a curse to all that come in contact with its force. Love, sanitized by reason, selfishness, enlightened by experiments, will eradicate ignorance in time and make wisdom welcome for all time. Now, here is a loving caricature of the surfesser, but we do have photos of the man himself. Here he is, a jolly old elf, a stout character, with Richard McKnight, one of the editors of The Eagle and Serpent, which was a magazine that Ragnar Redbeard and Seklu both appeared in. So here we have perhaps the corporal form of Evertrue, the well-fed, stout, two-fisted fireplug of a man. Again, the gospel, first published in 1927, as was Might is Right by Ragnar Redbeard. There were earlier editions, but the 1927 edition, surely the most well-known and well-read. You each have three copies, and if not, you will soon. Here is something that Kevin and I discovered in our research. There was a time where the two of them shared a street address on North Clark Street in Chicago. They ran in the same circles, and there's even some evidence that they wrote a few essays together that don't quite sound like either of them, but sound a little like both of them. I'm not sure that any of you brought Might is Right with you today, so I will read from Might is Right. Is the golden rule a rational rule? Is it not rather a menial rule, a rule of cowards, a best policy rule? Why is it right for one man to do unto others what he would have them do unto him? And what is right? If others are unable to injure him or do good to him, why should he consider them at all? Why should he take any more notice of them than so many worms? If they are endeavoring to injure him and able to do it, why should he refrain from returning the compliment? Should he not combat them, and does not this give him carte blanche to injure and to destroy them? Might it not be doing good to war with others, to annihilate them? May it not also be good for them to war against others? And again, what is good? Is it reasonable to ask praying animals to do unto others as they would be done by? If they acted accordingly, would they even survive? If some only accepted the golden rule as their guiding moral maxim, would they not be a prey to others who do not? Upon what reasonable and abiding sanction does this rule rest? Has it ever been in actual operation among men? Can it ever be successfully practiced on earth or anywhere else? The question requires no formal answering. The answers themselves in the asking. Now, could it be that the form of Malfeu Seklu and the vigor of Ragnar Redbeard are joined together in this scowling face, ever true? You'll have to make your own choices after I make them for you. The philosophy of all three of these men is that of egoism. I cite no less authority than myself on the subject. But I may also read from my own book published by Underworld Amusements, as represented by Kevin I. Slaughter today. Egoism is the claim that the individual is the measure of all things. In ethics, in epistemology, in aesthetics, in society, the individual is the best and only arbitrator. Egoism claims all social conventions, other people, religion, language, time, and all other forces outside of the individual are an impediment to the liberty of that individual. Such impediments may be tolerated, but they have no special standing to the individual, who may elect to ignore them or destroy them as he can. In egoism, the state has no monopoly to take tax or wage war. No monopoly to take tax or wage war. Why cede this to someone else? Why let them decide, well, we'll take some of that? We ask. Egoism was announced to the world by Max Stirner in his 1845 book, The Ego and Its Own. I have written the first and the best bibliography of Max Stirner. This is Max Stirner in print from the advent of The Ego and Its Own to 100 years later, to 1945. That seemed like a good cutoff point. In 1945, there wasn't much interest, as if there's ever been any interest in Max Stirner. But it took a dip there, surfaced again briefly in the 60s, took a little dip, and now Kevin and I are rolling in gold coins like Scrooge McDuck, of people lined about the door, beating down the windows to buy our books on egoism. If you are in a group, if you think of yourself, I am a member of this group, it is you who are in this group. It is you who have the criteria to know, this is a group worthy of me. It is you who have the knowledge that my criteria for judging my worthiness of this group is my own criteria. If there is a cause in the group, that is something that you and the group will be serving, and serving and serving for all time. Causes are hungry animals. They never quite get enough. But if the group and the cause are one, my group is my cause. There is no contradiction. To go back further to the first Me First book, which was The Prince by Machiavelli, that's a book on the health of the state. But it happens that the prince is the state. So in the words of, oh, here's how to have a healthy duchy, a healthy nation. Here's how to have a healthy, happy prince. Now I will close before the mad rush to the sales booth. And any questions answered, and I may answer any question, or I may not, with a quote from John Henry Mackay, one of the early advocates of Stirner, in his appreciation of Stirner that appeared in The Eagle and Serpent from 1900, over a century ago. He is speaking now of Stirner. Stirner does not come with the condescension of the priest. He is not in the service of God or any idea whatsoever, nor with the fussiness of the teacher. He leaves us to believe or reject what he says, and he does not come with the anxiety of the physician. He lets us live or die, for he knows that our fancy is our disease. Nor does he come like the philosopher who tries to catch us with the net of a new system of speculation. He despises the philosopher's language, the hideous, obscene, and unintelligible language of the philosopher, used as a privilege by those who only want to talk among themselves. He makes of himself a language of his own, for he knows that all knowledge can be intelligible when he wants it to be intelligible. He does not speak of us. He hardly speaks to us. He speaks only of himself. and always of himself only, and we see how this ego of his strips itself of one fetter after the other, until it stands free and unconquerable in proud self-splendor, as if its own master, the last on the field, which it has finally won. It is nothing more nor less than the declaration of the sovereignty of the individual, his incompatibility, and his uniqueness that Stirner announces. Hitherto, one had only spoken of his rights and his duties and where they begin and end. Stirner, however, declares that we are exempt from the latter and have control over the former. We must make our choice. And since we cannot go back into the night, we must enter into the day. For we now know that we are, all of us, egoists. When we survey our actions, we see that some of them have carried us further, much further, than our consciousness wishes to acknowledge, while others have gotten us entangled in discords quite incapable of being harmonized. Hereforth, it will be in vain for us any longer to attempt to deceive ourselves and others concerning the motives of our conduct. Now that we have acknowledged them, what else remains for us but to acknowledge ourselves to them? I thank you. In the gathering together of these incredible, life-changing comic strips, our own Kevin Slaughter found some original Everett True comic strips. These are from quite some time ago. These are available... 1921, I've been informed. These strips are from, and they're from a Portland newspaper, you say? From the Portland News,
yeah.
From the Portland News. And how many are here? Well, I see six. For the six lucky first purchasers of Outbursts of Everett True, an original strip will be gladly donated to Sam. Yes, yes, thank you. Thank you for coming, and thank you to Mother Foucault. Thank you to Mother Foucault and for all of you for being here today.
Deep in my heart and deep in my mind, deep in the depths of my ego, deep in my breast lies a treasure chest, a world that only I can know. You may criticize me, try to analyze me, put me in your little pigeonhole. I'll still hold the key to the place where I am free, a world that only I control. Deep in my heart, deep in my mind, deep in the depth of my ego, deep in my breast lies a treasure chest, a world that only I can know. I can love you dearly, I can love you too, I can love you long and love you well, but I must have my own song, only me can sing, my own tale that only I can tell. Deep in my heart, deep in my mind, deep in the depths of my ego, deep in my breast lies a treasure chest, a world that only I can know. Place me in your prison, put me in your cell, lock me up and throw away the key. I will up and wander, whim and fancy free, in this big world that's inside me. Deep in my heart, deep in my mind, deep in the depth of my ego, deep in my breast lies a treasure chest, a world that only I can know. Treasure chest, a world that only I can know.